This is Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. John Cranley and Roxanne Qualls were the top two vote-getters in this week's Cincinnati mayoral primary. That's not surprising. But the part that stunned many was that Cranley bested Qualls by 18 percentage points. Cranley ended up with nearly 56% of the unofficial vote count to just more than 37% for Qualls. It was the lowest voter turnout in the history of the Cincinnati mayoral primaries. Less than 6% showed up at the polls. Cranley, a former Cincinnati council member, and Qualls, the current vice mayor, will face each other in the November general election. We'll be discussing the mayor's race this hour and break down the field race for city council. You can join the conversation. Our phone number is 513-419-7100, or you can email us at talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. Joining us in the studio are Jean Beaupre, who's the Assistant Director of the Philosophy, Politics, and Public Honors Program at Xavier University, and Mac Mariani, who's an Associate Professor of Political Science at Xavier. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thanks.
Jean, let me start with you. The primary was this week. What's your takeaway from what happened, or maybe didn't happen, on Tuesday?
I think the most significant fact, let's put it that way, is the 6%. And, you know, 56% of the 6% is not the same as a real number. But it does give Cranley bragging rights. We can talk about why it was only 6%. I don't think any of the campaigns did a push, you know, to try and get their folks out. I think most of them just laid low. So 6% is a startling number. And it's hard to get down to that, but I think there's a collection of reasons to explain that. I don't think it's a particularly good predictor for what's happening in the future, but it does give. If you won, you won, and you know you go knock on doors now. I don't think for the winner, for Cranley, it's so much, you know, that he has the vote. It's that he can go now to his funders and other people and say, look, I'm doing well, and you know it's worth investing in me again.
Well, I think the real significance of it is that there was, I think, a sense before the primary that the de facto incumbent in this race was Roxanne Qualls. And she was running, I think, to some extent, an assumed incumbency strategy up until towards the very end when she ran the negative ads against Cranley. And I think the what we're going to see is that, you know, the assumed incumbency strategy has the candidate kind of back off and not want to create a lot of big moments in the campaign because everyone knows who's going to be the next mayor, and it's going to be Roxanne. And now, after the election result yesterday, now there's a real question. And so now I think the campaign's going to play out differently. She's going to have to change her strategy a little bit. She's going to continue to be more aggressive, the sort of more aggressiveness that we saw towards the end of the primary season. And, you know, Cranley, I think, is going to probably do more of the same. I think he feels good about his message, and I think that's he's going to try and use that to generate some turnout on Election Day. We'll see if he can do it.
Gene, you used the term startling for the 6% turnout, and again, you said there are a number of reasons for that. Could part of it be folks knew probably who the two winners were going to be, and we'll just stay home, and we'll wait until November to go vote?
Yeah, that's it. Howard's acknowledging that, too. Yeah, I think that's it. The candidates didn't push. And each of their supporters, each group of their supporters thought that, you know, they were going to be the top two. I don't think people paid a whole lot of attention to who finishes first or second. You know, the candidates do and the politicos like us do. But, you know, the reality is it's who can do well from here out.
People just didn't have any interest in this.
Right.
I mean, it was basically apathy. And also the realization, as you say, that they knew who was going to win.
Right.
I mean, you had to go back to like 2001, the very first mayoral primary that we had, where you had Curtis Fuller running against Charlie Lucan. And that was on 9/11/2001. Right. And we all know what happened that day.
Right.
And on that day, almost 15% of the people showed up at the polls. And this time it was 5.68. That is striking in terms of the apathy that was out there.
I think the another factor here is that the Democratic Party is in kind of the awkward position of having two candidates who are kind of loyal Democrats, and they're not going to want to get involved, and they're going to kind of back off. And so they're not going to spend a lot of money on turnout in a campaign when they know both of those candidates are coming back. When we get to the election day in November, they've got a whole slate of council people who they're going to be fighting to get as many of those council people on. So that's going to change in terms of the amount of money and manpower the party puts on the ground. I would expect that we're going to see a lot more of that than we did in the primary.
I agree. I think that's what's going to be fascinating. I mean, I'd love to have been in the campaign strategy meetings the next day or after they recovered from, you know, the night before. And what do you do? Do you remake yourself? Was this significant enough that you remake yourself? Does it tell you anything different that would make you alter your strategy? Other than, again, I think fundraising is a big deal. And, you know, we have two very different personalities here. For those that have a chance to watch him, or even in their campaign tech mode, you know, John Cranley is a pit bull. I mean, he just goes after it, and it comes across.
Don't you think that in Qual's case that they have to sit down and look at who it was that did not show up on Tuesday and whether or not those are the people who are inclined to vote for her, try to identify them and motivate them to get out to the polls in November?
I think every campaign has a basic formula. You have to know where your base is and you have to know where your swing is. And, you know, certainly you would count on your base to get out. The base is almost defined as if they know me, if they know I'm running, they already love me, and then all I have to do is get them to the polls. Well, a big part of that formula didn't happen. And so, yes, that's exactly right. I think they have to go back to their base. And, but that's sort of what I mean. What do you say to them now? You know, I mean,
right.
There'd be an inclination in me wrong to sort of shame them into saying, you know, we all lost this. Now we got to get together and, you know, do it right. I don't know, but that'll be tricky.
This gives Cranley bragging rights that he won the mayoral primary. 2001, 2005, the person who won the mayoral primary did not win the general election.
Curtis Fuller beat Charlie Lucan by 5,000 votes, didn't
right,
he?
Right, yeah, exactly.
Right.
And by 16 percentage points.
Yeah. So, right, it's just not a predictor, at least historically.
Does Cranley use that as a rallying cry to his supporters? And as history, as a guide here, the person who won the primary didn't win the general, so I need your help. I need your dollars.
I suspect he has a pocket full of things to say to people. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it was 2005 when David Pepper edged out Mark Mallory in the primary, and not by very much at all. And, of course, he ended up losing the general election. Now, in that primary, you had some other well-known candidates, Alicia Reese, Charlie Winburn, and their votes had to go somewhere, and they went to Mark Mallory in the general election. In this case, you look at the Jim Burns and Queen Noble, the minor candidates who are on the ballot. Well, it really doesn't matter where their votes go.
Right, right. That's what you come out of. That's what the candidates come out of this low turnout with, is no direction. There's no direction coming out. If you were in that other race you described, you go look and see, okay, where's my base now? And where's my swing? And this doesn't tell you anything.
But do you agree with Mac when he says that basically Cranley has hit upon a message that seems to work and needs to keep hammering away at that?
I think that's right. If one could interpret this victory as he ought to take the high ground now and, you know, maybe back off a little bit, the message that he's had to deliver is so good because everybody understands it in a couple words. You know, it's the parking system and it's the streetcar. Right. And, you know, people understand what – it's like the IRS issue when it came up. Everybody understands the IRS because they're in your back pocket, you know, for your money. So, you know, that's – now, I'd like to see him expand. I mean, if I were offering strategy, I'd like to see him expand to get as wide a base as he can, or as wide a base and swing as he can. And that might be adopting additional messages. You know as well as I do, the fear is too many messages, then nobody's paying attention.
Well, and you see with the pension issue that came up, I think Cranley, you know, that would be an issue of reform where you would expect this is the sort of thing that he would be appealed to. But he basically took the same position as Roxanne, right? And he says, listen, I've got my issues. I'm not going to create another divisive issue that maybe my opponent can use as a wedge against me.
You have to spend some time explaining what the pension issue is to your audience,
right.
And that's time lost. That's an expense, and why do that?
And there's a very mobilized constituency of city employees who are going to work against it, so that doesn't make any sense for
– Yeah.
And wouldn't Cranley have to be a little bit concerned on the pension issue since he sat on the pension board when he was on council that he may not necessarily have clean hands with – some of the expansion that happened to the pension benefits as he was a member of the pension board.
And how long did it take you to say that?
Right. Well, yeah. Jay's exactly right. And that is how Qualls would respond.
Right.
But to put that in a 30-second TV ad is tough.
Right.
Well, and when they both have basically the same position on the issue, it's even tougher.
Right.
Given the limited amount of data, since there was only a 6% turnout, when you look at the who won what parts of the city, Roxanne's was sort of in the center, close to downtown. Cranley was on the outskirts, east and west. Can we take anything away from that?
Well, I think, clearly he's the west side favorite because there's a lot of opposition on the west side to the streetcar, to the parking lease plan. And, he won these great chunks of areas like Mount Washington, and, some of the more concerned. And he also won an awful lot of African-American precincts, if you look at it.
So,
and to me, that's going to be the key to this race.
Right. I agree. I think you and I have talked about this, Howard. I think talking in broad terms, Cranley gets the west side and Roxanne, maybe with the exception of Mount Washington, gets the east side. And the fight's in the middle, which is generally the African-American vote. And it's interesting because each candidate has different African-American advocates for them. And that may make a big difference, too. I mean, the mayor is openly supportive of Qualls.
We're talking about this year's Cincinnati mayoral race, discussing the results of this week's primary election and looking ahead to the general election in November. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU's Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. Today we're talking about the Cincinnati mayoral and city council races in November. Our guests are Gene Beaupre, who's the assistant director of the Philosophy, Politics, and Public Honors Program at Xavier University, and Mac Mariani, who's an associate professor of political science at Xavier. You can join the conversation by calling 513-419-7100. Or emailing talk at wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter. Again, 513-419-7100. We were talking before the break about the African-American vote.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Howard was talking about there's actually a split in that group about who they're going to support for mayor.
Yeah, there's a split among the leadership in the African-American community. Obviously, Roxanne Qualls has the mayor's support. She has the support of some of the former NAACP presidents. On the other hand, Cranley has State Representative Alicia Reese, has Christopher Smitherman, the councilman, on his side, and others who are going to go out and actively campaign for her. Now, I'm not sure how much of that's going to happen on the Qualls side, where you have personal campaigning by Mark Mallory for Roxanne Qualls. He supports her. His old campaign manager is her campaign manager. But how involved do you think he would get?
Well, and I think that's a good question. Let me just preface it by saying I don't think there's any voter group that's more important for the grassroots, door-to-door kind of thing as the African-American community. So that's an important distinction to make. And I think if the Qualls campaign is smart, they'll at least create events or have him go to events with her and do that sort of thing. People who pay attention to this know that, for instance, Alicia Reese, she basically, she owns Bond Hill in terms of getting the vote, and that's a big block of votes right there. What's equivalent on the other side that
right.
All the votes are important, but that may be where the swing stuff is.
One of the things that strikes me is that both of them being former – or well, in the case of Cranley being a former councilman and Roxanne obviously being a current one, in the last election, for instance, she received 52% of the vote. She was the highest vote getter. But that means that 48% of the voters who had 9 votes to give – and they don't use them all usually – didn't give one of the 9 to her, right? And it was mm-hmm. it's a so I think the 9x race is not as it's not a huge springboard in terms of name recognition and also in terms of building a base of support and also an organization. The legislators don't have the same sorts of organizations that they might have if they were in a district level race, larger district level race.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in other words, a head to head race is a whole lot different than a field race.
Yeah, you have to have a different style, you have to approach things differently, and you have to really tap into people in a different way than saying, "Hey, I need to be one of your top 9." That's a different question entirely.
I think Roxanne has, and I just know more about her recent history because she's been on council. She has traditionally adopted whatever the current issues are, but then she's also been involved in issues that are long-term issues that recruit people at a neighborhood level who see her in a different kind of way. And that, frankly, is one of the groups the kind of person I thought would show up, and they didn't. But I think it's for the reason we talked about early. I think, and so that's different in terms of a base than what I think John Cranley has. And now I think the question is for Roxanne: how does she get beyond that to get the make up the difference? And frankly, the African American community once again is a big part of that.
We are talking today about the Cincinnati mayor's race and the race, the contest this fall between Roxanne Qualls, the current vice mayor, and former council member John Cranley. And both have already been on television, and we have got the audio from some of their ads. We're going to start with a theme that you're probably going to hear a lot from the Qualls campaign in the coming months.
We know what it takes to fix the neighborhoods. It takes great community leadership. We have to invest more resources into the neighborhoods. I started out working in neighborhoods, and as mayor, I will do whatever I can to help our families, creating more public preschools, and investing in all 52 neighborhoods, creating jobs and local businesses. We know what the formula for success is. That's how we're going to make Cincinnati better. And that's what I will do as mayor.
That ad from the Roxanne Qualls campaign, and the next ad is from the Cranley campaign, and a theme that you're probably going to hear a lot between now and November.
The current leadership of City Hall are raising property taxes to build a streetcar and planning to sell off our parking meters. These are the wrong priorities.
Roxanne Qualls, she's a big streetcar supporter.
Roxanne Qualls' streetcar plan will waste $133 million, and her plan privatizes the city's parking meters, outsourcing them to a company that will raise rates.
This is the wrong vision for the future. We need to approach every decision by saying, will this make our neighborhoods better, our schools better? Will this bring more jobs to Cincinnati? And that is my priority as mayor.
And things were pretty calm on the ad front until last week when the Qualls campaign released this ad.
John Cranley got $750,000 from the city for his development. But before he could take our tax money, the Ohio Ethics Commission told him to resign from city council or face ethics charges for conflict of interest. So Councilman Cranley resigns, takes $750,000 of our tax dollars, and now he's a lobbyist, John Cranley, helping John Cranley.
And it did not take long until the Cranley campaign responded with this ad.
The former Ohio ethics chair called John Cranley a model for public officials on ethics. So why is Roxanne Qualls attacking Cranley for creating new jobs, a project she voted for? Maybe it's because Qualls is desperate. She can't defend her streetcar project that's wasting millions and robbing our neighborhoods of services. And Qualls knows her parking plan will raise rates and hurt businesses. Roxanne Qualls. False ads, bad ideas. Cincinnati deserves better.
Just some of the ads that have been on local television for the Cincinnati mayor's race. That last set of ads with Will Barrow, the actor coming out of City Hall with a wheelbarrow full of money, taking a dollar from a baby in a stroller, dog doing its business on a sign that says Cranley for Cranley. Gene, did that?
Sorry.
And I mean, you're down City Hall, they were laughing about it yesterday, yeah. too. Did that surprise you that the Qualls campaign put that ad out there?
You know, there wasn't much from the Qualls campaign. The week before the primary, my house was inundated with three Qualls pieces. And, you know, just objectively, you have to step back and say, did this come out because they saw numbers that said they had to mobilize?
I was going
to
ask, typically a candidate tends to start going negative when the numbers are going the wrong way.
Well, you know, and I
that's the rule, general rule of thumb.
But the other argument would be, well, there's no sense in spending a lot of money in this. And so they just tried to take a real powerful high megaton shot at the end.
But it was a high megaton shot that was fairly easy to answer.
Mm-hmm.
As Cranley did in his spot.
Yeah.
So was it a misfire? I mean, was it just...
If you do that, you give him a reason to come back and to do that sort of thing. So sure, I think, you know, I don't know that it was a misfire. I mean, we're all sitting here listening to him in a matter of 2 minutes, and I don't know how it plays out. But yeah, I mean, going negative is risky for a bunch. Using humor. Roxanne used humor. If humor works, it's great. If it doesn't work, you look stupid.
I just had a question that slipped my mind. With the ads, both of these candidates have run for Congress against Steve Chabot. Does that influence the ads that they're going to run in the mayor's race? Since they ran against Steve Chabot, both lost. Now they're running against each other, and the experience that they had being attacked by the Chabot campaign, that it carries over to the mayor's race too?
Well, at least it's a one-on-one. It's a head-on-head. And, you know, that's a different ballgame, as we've talked about, than city council. I mean, you know, nobody attacks people on city council with any benefit to it. So, you know, I think they know how to do one-on-one now, or at least that's what they're trying to do.
Well, I think where we have, too, also, is that the Cranley is able, in his attack ads, to come back to the core issues in his campaign, which I think makes them more powerful, whereas – the Qualls ads are focused on Cranley's a lobbyist, so they seem more personal. Even though the Cranley ads are an attack on Roxanne, they don't seem as personal because they're tied in with a policy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that you have to be careful as a candidate. You don't quite know. I remember one time doing we did some negative ads for – I used to run campaigns in New York. And we did some negative ads on the west side. And we had the exact same ad on the east side of the city. This is in Rochester. And in the west side, the guy's like, this is fantastic. It's working well. The guy from the east side came back. He's like, what have you done to me? I'm getting so many negative calls. And it really, you know, to different groups of people, mm-hmm. they're going to react differently to the exact same message.
One of the differences is that when these two were running against Steve Chabot, you know, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee was calling the shots.
Yep.
And that's not the case here.
Right.
They have to call their own shots.
Right, right.
We talked about the African-American leaders being split. Where do Republicans shake out in this since they have no candidate on the ballot? I know Howard wrote a blog item and did a column about the fact that Republicans were giving campaign cash to John Cranley. So what do they do?
I think it depends on which Republicans you're talking about. If they're Mount Washington Republicans, that's one thing. If they're CBC, if they're corporate Republicans, that's probably something different. And there, you're not obviously you want more than their vote. You know, you want to check. You know, I think the Republicans want to support somebody so they can pick up the phone and call them. But by and large, I think the Republican Party, and I've said this in other situations, has written off the city. They own the county. You know, they control the county in terms of the county commission. They control the state. And, you know, they can mount an effort. If John Cranley gets elected and he's got a treasure chest from them, you know, he's going to respond to their calls. But beyond that, I think they're not going to bother to play in that garden.
Yeah, I mean, I think that all things being equal, the issues that Cranley is running on are going to probably appeal to the Republican voters because Roxanne is seen as the status quo candidate, the candidate who's kind of with the Democratic establishment, and Cranley is kind of going against them on some very key issues. Now, they're both Democrats. So, you know, Republicans either way are going to end up with a Democratic mayor. But all things being equal, he'll probably get more Republican votes than she will.
Well, that was interesting that Alex Triantafilou, the chairman of the Hamilton County Republican Party, put out a message the morning after the election saying that, yes, he knows that, you know, a lot of Republicans have supported Cranley. But he reminded Republicans that they're both Democrats. And, you know, but the fact is he has no candidate.
Yeah. So I don't know what that message is.
I don't know
that
what
mean
the
you stay home
yeah,
or what?
Right.
I don't, you know, I mean, there's.
Well, and I think Cranley has to be careful because he doesn't want to be seen as the de facto Republican in this race because he'll lose.
Right.
He has to keep a distance. And I'm sure the Republican Party.
Triantafilou's only motivation now is to try to turn people out for his four candidates for city council.
Yeah. Yeah.
Before we – there have been, again, with the 6% turnout, there's already at least one call to reform the system. But before we talk about reforming the system, Howard, maybe I can turn to you. Tell me why we ended up the system that we have now, why there's a primary when, you know, we have the experience that it's a field race. You know, everybody jumps in. The nine candidates win the council race. Why not have just a big race for mayor and the top vote getter in the mayor's race is the mayor?
Well, we did that for quite a while, Jay, and people really didn't like it that much. I mean, it was, you know, everybody was competing to be the top vote getter. There was a sense that even if you became the top vote getter in those days, the mayor had no real power.
Well, but I guess what I'm saying, though, instead of having the primary, you still have a mayor's race, a separate mayor's race. Why not just anybody that wants to run for mayor, you have the race in November. Why did they decide that they needed this primary?
Well, they needed the primary in order to basically have two serious candidates face each other in the fall instead of this monstrous, you know, instead of having two great big long lists of names on the ballot. A city council race and a mayor's race, you'd be able to narrow this down. So it's a head-to-head contest, whether it's a Republican running against a Democrat like it was 4 years ago or whether it's two Democrats running against each other as it is this year. It's a clear choice, and I think that's what they wanted because the mayor has – under the charter now, much more authority than he or she did some years ago.
Well, and let's not forget that one of the advantages of having a primary for the political candidates is that it allows you to have two separate elections in which you're raising money.
Bingo.
So it allows the mayoral candidates to raise money for the primary, and then after the primary – start at zero, start raising money again, and it allows them to get essentially twice as much money out of each individual donor if they can get it.
That's right.
I think the thing to watch going forward is whether the messages that the two candidates, and I think specifically about Cranley, does that have traction? Does that have endurance all the way to the end? Can you just talk about streetcar And should you just talk about streetcar and parking meters, or you know, does he have to change someplace? He does a good job in his commercial of having a positive and a negative, but it's all still centered around those two issues.
But clearly, for him, he wants this to be sort of a third referendum on the streetcar and the referendum voters didn't get on the parking lease.
Right, but I'm just saying, you know, it's September. And does that run for the next, you know, whatever?
I mean, I think at some point, you know, he has to lay out a vision of his own for the city, you know, not just say this was wrong, she was wrong about that, she was wrong about this, you know, and lay out his own vision for what he wants to do with 4 years in the mayor's office.
And I agree with you. And in some ways, both candidates have done that on jobs, you know, and that's what But that's not what I'm asking. How do they appeal to the voters? Voters don't read that stuff, you know.
Yeah.
What's the 30-second spot? Does it stay the same thing or does it change?
Let's do I'm sorry, Matt.
Well, on the flip side, too, is that for Roxanne Qualls, I think one issue is, is there a way for her to demonstrate what she's going to do differently over the next 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a challenge, right? Yeah. Without alienating her, the mayor or other supporters, what is she going to do differently? Because there are problems that people aren't happy with. And she's laid out some issues, but it's not really clear how that's any different than what we've seen.
And that's hard to do in 30 seconds.
Very difficult.
Let's do a what if here. If John Cranley is elected mayor, he's adamantly opposed to the streetcar project, which is now being built.
Right.
Does he try to stop it?
Back it up, as it were? I don't know the answer to that. I honestly don't. I mean, we lose some money, I think, and, you know, things like that. One thing you have to remember about the mayor is the mayor doesn't vote. So, you know, you still need 5 votes on council to make things happen. And it could be a pretty prickly relationship for a while.
But the mayor controls what is on the council agenda.
Yeah, I guess that's true. Statutorily,
yeah.
They do. Yeah, you're right. But it's still a clash of power, you mm-hmm. know. There's things that the council, if they were organized well enough, could not give the mayor if he wanted or she wanted it. But that is the $64 question. And the same with the parking
meters.
Could
be closer to $148 million
right,
question.
Right, but who's counting?
I think there'd be something symbolically beneficial to him if he does win to actually stop the project. I think that there's something to be said for this is what I ran on. I'm going to follow through with it. And ultimately, even though there's lost money potentially, even though there's a lost possibility that it might work, people won't blame him. They'll blame the people who moved forward with the project and said this is something we should never have done. I think he could go either way on it.
Yeah.
We're talking about the race to be Cincinnati's next mayor and the field contest to fill the 9 city council seats. We haven't talked yet about city council. We're going to do that coming up. You're listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is 91.7 WVXU Cincinnati Edition. I'm Jay Hanselman with Howard Wilkinson. We're discussing the November election in Cincinnati when voters will select the city's next mayor and 9 city council members. Our guests today are Jean Beaupre, who's the assistant director of the Philosophy, Politics, and Public Honors Program at Xavier University, and Mac Mariani, who's an associate professor of political science at Xavier. You can join our discussion. Our number is 513-419-7100 or email talk@wvxu.org. We're also on Facebook and Twitter, 513-419-7100. Before we leave the mayor's race, I'm going to – and you two can pick. Gene, you go first. You either are advising the Cranley campaign or the Qualls campaign. You pick one of the candidates. What does that person need to do between now and November?
You know, that's an interesting question because the natural tendency would be to pick the one who came out on top. But, you know, then you can only go down from there. And if you go to the person who at least some would argue isn't doing as well, I think there's a long time between now and then. I think that Cranley will have – I would go with Cranley only in terms of the mechanics of the campaign, about his ability to mobilize, about his message, about who he is as a candidate, and particularly his ability to mobilize in strategically important areas given this race. So if I want to be sitting at the winning table at the end, that's where I would go.
He left you Roxanne Qualls. How do you advise them?
I think the most important thing, right, is the old Hitchhiker's Guide advice, don't panic, right? It's I think that she was the front runner in this race for a reason. I mean, she knows the issues well. She's very widely respected. She has very deep connections to a lot of people in this community. I think she needs to figure out a way to separate herself from Cranley without turning it into a mud fest. I think that, and she needs to talk about issues in a way that connect with her voters and bring them out. I mean, these are very simple things, but I'd say don't panic. I wouldn't want to, if I were her, I wouldn't change, upend my campaign completely and be somebody who I'm not, because I think that never works.
Some people seem to think that she's like too cool or too distant, you know, does she need to change her style or personal style?
Well, I think there are ways for potentially to turn that to your advantage, to maybe make temperament an issue, to say, you know, listen, you know, we need a leader who can work together with people and maybe say that, listen, John Cranley doesn't have that temperament. You know, now you have to do that and find a venue where that's going to really connect with voters. And you have to do that in a way that doesn't seem fabricated. So but there'll be debates and there'll be other places like that where maybe she has an opening.
I think that a campaign is not an intellectual exercise, and it's about passion. And I think Roxanne's been a wonderful in her elected position. And I think you're onto something there, Howard, to say, somehow or other, it's got to appear more engaged and appear to have more passion about the things.
Make a connection with people.
Pardon?
make a connection with people.
Right. Say it in a way that people understand, you know, that you are connecting with them. Right.
We've been saying throughout, 40-some minutes here that we're going to talk about council, so we better do that, not spend all of our time focusing on the mayor's race. There are all nine Cincinnati council members are on the ballot. Actually, there are only eight on the ballot because Roxanne Qualls is a current council member and running for mayor. She cannot run for council. So there are eight incumbents on the ballot. I think Howard and I figured up there are what we would call four veteran candidates who have run before or have been on council before.
That's correct.
And nine first-time candidates.
That's correct.
So 21 candidates. Discuss the field for us.
Three of those four who have been on the ballot before have actually served on council. You know, David Mann, obviously, for many, many years. Amy Murray, the Republican, who was a appointed council member in 2011 and lost the election that year. And you also had Sam Malone, who served one term in the early 1990s. Kevin Flynn, the Charterites, run twice before. He's running again. And those people, you know, have some experience on the ballot. The rest of the field, aside from the incumbents, don't have that.
Pam Thomas,
right,
who is on the ballot and is an incumbent but has not run before, if I'm not mistaken.
But she has run for county office.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Last year she ran for county office for clerk of courts did pretty well and won the city. So, you know, that's why some people look at her as a serious.
Mm-hmm.
Gene, you've talked about this. You always say, I think, name recognition is important in a 9X field race.
It's the only thing that's important.
So how do you do that?
Well, if you have a lot of money, it's easy. You know, you buy TV and you do direct mail and you get your legion of workers out and go door to door. It is, and I like it for this reason. You know, a lot of it is very grassroots campaigning. You know, not many candidates have the money to go on TV. What do you think? Maybe four candidates, five candidates might. You can't go on TV unless you reach a certain.
Yeah, maybe five or six.
You have to reach a certain threshold.
Right.
If you can't buy enough TV to saturate, there's no sense in doing it. So a lot of it is real good targeting and really delivering what you think is an impactful message to that particular audience that you're trying to do. And maybe the other thing that's, you know, about which I know very little is the social media stuff, which, you know, it can play in all this. So it's nice, and that it's kind of ironic because there's 21 candidates, but you really have to do that grassroots thing.
Yeah, I agree. I think the constituency service is critical, especially for those members who are on council now. I mean, you look at Seelbach and you look at Sittenfeld, I think, have been models of how to work constituencies. And, you know, they didn't just focus on one. They got to hit a lot of them because you're representing the whole city. I think that obviously that helps you raise money. That helps you connect with people. I think what you really have to look at is, you know, if there's any members who haven't done that, who haven't used that position to the best of their ability over the last couple of years, you know, will they drop? I expect Seelbach, for instance, to move up the list fairly high this time around. Obviously, PG has both money and I think an excellent record in terms of constituency
service. And those people, because they've gotten their name in the newspaper or they've gotten their 30 seconds on TV or something like that. Can I raise one other quick thing? We can't forget that this is now for a 4-year term.
Right.
And if name recognition is the important thing, the candidates, the office holders that are at the end of their first 4-year term, you'd have to blow them out of there with dynamite. You know, I mean, they're going to, unless they've done something really stupid, you know, they're going to have massive name recognition by then.
Does that
if they're any good?
Does that influence voters though when they're in there marking their ballot? You know, think, do I really want this person at City Hall for 4 years as
when
opposed to when it has been 2 years?
Well, no, I think it does, unless there's something really negative that motivates them to vote against these people. You know, that their voting record or whatever. I mean, you know, people are. Generally, in Cincinnati City Council elections, people pay pretty close attention, I think.
Maybe for their first three votes.
Right.
And then they may do two more or three more. And
that,
you know, I'm happy to get those. I don't care if they really know me as long as I get their vote.
Yeah, the average voter goes into the polls and votes for 6.3 candidates.
Right.
That's, you know.
Right. That's exactly right. So, you know, it is name recognition. And it's very hard.
It seems to be there's in many council races one person who runs for the first time, who raises a whole lot of money and breaks through. Sittenfeld did it. David Pepper did it years ago. Phil Heimlich did it years ago. Do you two think, Cease, who's your pick to click here in 2013?
You know, I don't necessarily think he's going to move to the top, but, you know, I've always had a soft spot for Kevin Flynn.
Yeah.
I think he connects really well with people. I think having been out this, you know, again, I think meeting more people, I think, you know, he'd be one I wouldn't be surprised if, you know, he's not going to be two or three, but, you know, if he gets in an eight or nine, I wouldn't be shocked.
We were calculating in class the other day that it takes between 23 and 25,000 votes to finish ninth, depends on the turnout. So you have to think of somebody that will be remembered by 23,000 people or a reasonable, you know, facsimile of that. And it's hard. I tend to agree with about Kevin. It's hard for me because I know them. And so it's harder to know, you know, in that field race, who knows who.
In the mayor's race, we talk about John Cranley can, you know, talk about Roxanne's support for the streetcar project and the parking lease. And clearly there are five incumbents for sure who have supported the streetcar project.
Mm-hmm.
How do opponents of those projects hang those votes on those council members when it's a field race?
You have to hang it on them as they run out of the room when the topic comes up, because I don't think any of them are active. Well, I shouldn't say that. Think targeted. There are people who support the streetcar. And in fact, there was an article in the Inquirer a while back that was a survey about the name recognition of that issue, and it was very high. But there was a second question or someplace down in there that said, "How much would this influence your vote?" And it was very low. So, you know, I think that's you can't run from those things. If you're good, you say, you know, that's a really good question. But the real question is, what are we going to do about, you know, X, Y, or Z?
It's very difficult to run negative ads in a 9X race because you're going to get some blowback against you. It's not going to, you know, it's all about name recognition. It's all about positive, letting people feel good about you. This, I think, it'd be very difficult to do that.
There was a discussion about a movement to do this that was generated out of some West Side leadership, and the point was they would go down the incumbent list, pick the ones that were most vulnerable, and they don't have to move that many votes. You know, if you can figure out their base, you just go to their base or their swing, and you try and move those votes.
Yeah, and they're going to try to do that again this year.
Are they? I didn't know whether they were.
Oh, yes.
I haven't heard.
They're actively organizing to do that again this year.
Well, I'd be a little worried about that.
But when you have a choice between two people, it's easy to vote against somebody.
Right.
It's much more different when you get in that with a big long list of people. Oh, who am I voting against is not the question you're thinking about.
In 2011, there was a state issue on the ballot, Senate Bill 5, that would have changed reformed pensions,
mm-hmm.
or made changes to the public union employees in Ohio. And some people thought that drove turnout and influenced the council race. There were, four incumbent council members who didn't return.
Mm-hmm.
Could the issue this year on the city ballot reforming the city pension system do the same thing?
There is a constituency. I don't know that it would be as well organized. Howard may know more about the personalities in this. And, you know, that for the labor movement, that issue was a do or die. If they didn't pass that, I mean, they would look anemic. And so they put everything they could behind it. I don't think there's
pension is sort of a labor issue, too.
Well, it is. But, yeah. Organized labor is, you know, obviously going to be opposed to this thing.
Mm-hmm.
Now, whether or not they have the passion and are willing to commit the resources to this that they did to Senate Bill 5,
That's
an open question.
Right.
But, you know, it could have an impact.
And in that one, there was a person, the governor.
Oh, yes.
That they, you know, I mean, that's all you had to say to mobilize people.
A villain that they could go after.
Part of, you know, the state party had a very strong incentive to try to, you know, listen, we can put one nail at least in John Kasich's coffin.
Right. Well, and that was also a dress rehearsal basically for the Obama campaign the next year, you know, to see if they could get their people out to the polls. And they did.
They sure did.
I'll give you both this chance. Your best guess now, we know there'll be at least one new council member. 8 incumbents and 1 new member, 7 incumbents, 2 new member. What are your early thoughts on what the new council could look like?
You know, I actually have no idea. It's if we get a turnout like we did this last week, we might see 9 new ones. I don't know.
And it's September. I mean, if you ask it, you know, later on, I think you'll have a better chance of seeing, you know, what campaigns have been able to do. I mean, we talked about this already. I think Kevin Flynn's got some recognition and stuff like that. But
beyond, organizationally, and the, Landsman, I think.
Landsman. Oh, I'm sorry. I forgot.
Landsman has a whole lot of money.
He's got it right. He's got, yes, I'm sorry. That's I guess I presume that's a given for, you know, and I shouldn't say it that way, but, you know, he's running. Not only does he have the money, he's using it well. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of people who have money and don't use it well, but he is.
And he's not ignoring the grassroots either. He's got a big field team.
He's everywhere.
Just real, since we have political experts in the room, let's talk about one national issue, the decision on whether or not to do limited military action in Syria. What, Michael, let me start with you, the politics of that decision.
I think it's been an absolutely disastrous couple of weeks for President Obama. I think the in some ways, and this started with kind of a gaffe, in the sense a rhetorical gaffe, when the president talked about a red line, which had not really been vetted with the State Department, had not really been talked about, and now then felt obligated to kind of hold up that rhetoric, and then found that Congress wasn't behind him, and then it ends with a gaffe with John Kerry accidentally opening the door for UN inspectors. I think that the danger for President Obama is that this becomes a Katrina-like moment where it kind of crystallizes what people think or fear about the man. It's entirely possible that he wins very big over the next couple weeks, next couple months on the budget, and we forget about it. But it was, I think it was the low point of his presidency so far.
Gene?
I've never seen political maneuvering. Now, I'm not an expert in this area. The way this went when he moved it, sent it over to, you know, the Congress said, you know, we want a part of it. And it's like, again, it's like the dog catching the car. Okay, here it is. Now what are you going to do with it? But then it's just gotten out of control since then. I'll get calls on this, but it's a comedy of errors by the U.S. government. And that's what the rest of the world thinks. And Putin's op-ed piece in the New York Times was eloquent compared to, you know, what's come out of the White House. And I don't know what the fallout is. I mean, all this stuff goes away over time. But I guess the president's probably happy he can only serve 2 terms.
Mike, I think this was an article earlier this week in the Enquirer where somebody talked about a civil war within the Republican Party, especially on this issue, where you had House Speaker John Boehner saying he was for it, other members of the House.
I think there's been a significant shift among Republicans. I think Republicans were obviously very supportive of Iraq and Afghanistan. I think the attitude among Republican rank and file voters is, listen, we've tried to fix the Middle East. We've, you know, spent a lot of money. We've given many lives to that cause. They're not quite sure what we would accomplish. And I think they're very reluctant to get involved in more wars. And when we talk about, you know, I think, oh, this isn't a war. We're just going to shoot some missiles off and it's going to be incredibly small. What is the point? And two, you can't predict what's going to happen once you start shooting missiles off. You kill a big group of Russians, then everything changes.
Gene, we'll give you the last word in about 30 seconds.
Well, there's a part of this that is also a moral issue that plays out on both sides and in many different ways. I mean, do we have a responsibility, and I don't know where we got this or presume we do, to go in and fix something that, you know, we didn't have anything to do with, and that we may feel that way. And, and then there's the moral issue that says we've got no business doing this. I mean, it just plays in a lot of ways, but I don't know. It's been painful to watch.
Thank you both for being here.
Thanks. You.
We've been discussing the fall races for Cincinnati mayor and city council. Our guests were Gene Beaupre, who's the assistant director of the Philosophy, Politics, and Public Honors Program at Xavier University, and Mac Mariani, who's an associate professor of political science at Xavier. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. Archives of our programs are available on our website, WVXU.org. Producer for today's program was Pete Reitmeier. Our technical director was Rick Andrus. With Howard Wilkinson, I'm Jay Hanselman.